say they're trying to be helpful, but if Boris Johnson doesn't like the deal, he shouldn't have signed it. Saeed Bourza, London.
Pakistan has announced a $55 billion US annual budget. The country's opposition parties attempted to block the proceedings of the budget, calling it an IMF-dictated budget and burden on the poor people.
We have come up with a budget which would focus on the welfare of every segment of the society. From 1st July, all government employees would be provided 10% ad hoc increase in their salaries.
However, no one among these protesters outside the parliament in the federal capital were willing to trust the government, which linked a controversial bailout package with the IMF about 3 years ago. Under IMF pressure, Pakistan significantly devalued its currency, raised interest rate, and increased tax rates, which led to massive price hike, inflation, and brought down the growth rate.
The government is scared of IMF, and the government and its ministers are helpless. They had agreement with us to provide us a reduced share in the budget, but they are coming up with a budget which will hit hard the poor people.
Just few months back, the protesters forced the ruling party to ink an agreement with them to provide substantial increase to hundreds of thousands of the government employees. However, now they feel betrayed after government only provided them of what they called an insignificant raise in their salaries. Few weeks ago, Prime Minister Imran Khan sacked his finance minister for towing IMF agenda. Nonetheless, the economic problems are far from over. Pakistan's economy begins to recover with more revenue and more remittances. However, the government is failing to provide relief to the common people suffering from rising unemployment and extraordinary surge in their utility bills. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
The COVID-19 pandemic has hampered India's ambition of double-digit growth by 2022. In its latest report, the World Bank has slashed the country's growth forecast to 8.3% from 10.1% estimated earlier. The service sector is the hardest hit, the report added, stressing on higher spending on infrastructure, rural development and healthcare. The ongoing economic turmoil sparked by COVID pandemic has dragged millions in poverty and unemployment.
The damage was already done with the COVID first wave, but whatever was left, second wave devastated it further. It is very hard to find work these days because there is less activity in construction sector.
In recent weeks, the government announced a set of policies related to spending after a pandemic deteriorated the economic prospectus. The central bank also announced measures for micro, small and medium businesses. Over the last few months, India has been struggling with a ferocious second wave of the COVID-19 pandemic with around 400,000 daily cases and thousands of deaths. Hospitals were reeling under a shortage of space, oxygen, beds and vaccines. This prompted the government to announce more stringent lockdowns, which resulted in huge economic costs for the world's second most populous nation, where millions rely on daily wages. Migrant workers were the hardest hit.
No matter what it is, the poor people are the ones who struggle most. Rich people have savings, they can survive. But what about us? The second wave has finished everything we had. If these lockdowns continue, we will die.
The government of Prime Minister Modi has faced criticism over handling COVID crisis. The pandemic with economic slowdown has devastated the livelihood of millions in India. The country is also staring at unemployment crisis, with youth being the worst affected. Observers say to counter slowing economy and unemployment crisis, India needs to launch more stimulus packages and job support schemes the way other developed nations did after COVID ravaged their economies. But fear of third wave in India is creating further doubts if the country is ready to deal with another looming situation. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
As EU leaders continue to try and grapple with COVID-19, hundreds of visitor hotspots across the bloc are more like ghost towns due to ongoing travel restrictions. The European Parliament has approved the EU Digital Travel Certificate. It is supposed to be operational by the 1st of July. Seven EU nations are already using it, but some countries say they won't until the middle of July.
The patchwork is still here, the spaghetti of rules and regulations. Dear national governments, it is in your hands to make sure that people can travel freely.
The new travel cert will show if someone has been vaccinated, recovered from COVID-19, or has had a negative test. A large cohort of EU lawmakers are furious. The tests will not be free. They claim it is a mechanism to effectively force citizens to get vaccinated. People struggling financially who don't want or don't have access to the jab will not be able to travel, legislators point out. Tests could also be very costly for cross-border workers. This is all very discriminatory, legislators say. Free movement of people within the 27-nation EU is supposed to be a fundamental right. The lack of travel is having a devastating economic impact.
Uncertainties remain as the near-term economic outlook continues to depend on the course of the pandemic and how the economy responds after reopening.
Official data shows the youth unemployment rate in the EU is double that of the general population, and that might be an underestimation.
I think it's definitely hard, especially if you start working after studying. I had a lot of friends, even with a good diploma, that had some problems in finding a job, like my brother, for example.
The job market is not very high, actually, so yeah, I mean, COVID, of course, increases this situation, but we are scared anyway.
The EU travel certificate is being hailed as a tool to jumpstart the bloc's economy, but many lawmakers have data protection concerns.
This crisis is being misused in order to get unpopular things through the back door. These doors should remain shut. The certificate should in no way be used to assert control.
Amid growing fears over people's jobs, the European Central Bank has again appealed to EU leaders not to dither over the deployment of COVID-19 recovery funding. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Israeli forces have shot dead some Palestinians in a pre-dawn raid in the city of Jenin, northern the occupied West Bank. Israeli forces raided Jenin to carry out an arrest operation, according to the Israeli military. Outside the headquarters of the Palestinian Authority's military intelligence, a shootout erupted between Israeli soldiers and Palestinian security forces. During the operation, Israeli forces killed Jamil Al-Amouri, a member of the Jihad movement and a former prisoner, and also arrested another operative whom Israel claims it was looking for both.
What happened in Jenin is a new crime. Israel has got crazy after facing resistance by the Palestinians in Al-Quds, the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Now it's seeking to show its strength by more killings. It thinks that these killings would prevent the Palestinians from continuing their struggle, but the Palestinians have shown that they won't give in to pressure.
Palestinian factions from across the political spectrum called a general strike in the city to mark the deaths of those killed. Thousands of mourners turned out on the streets in Jenin City to take part in the funeral's procession of the security officers. A third funeral has not been held, as the Israeli forces had arrested the third man before he succumbed to his injuries.
There are orders from the Israeli authorities to accelerate the situation. Netanyahu doesn't want to leave office. He doesn't want to be imprisoned. That's why he wants to make an escalation. But Israel must know that it would pay a high price for its crimes.
The Palestinian presidency has meanwhile condemned the Israeli operation in Jenin, with spokesman Nabil Aburdena holding the Israeli regime responsible for this escalation and its consequences.
Israeli forces have not yet handed over the body of the third Palestinian killed during Jenin raid, Jamil Al-Amouri, a former prisoner and member of the Jihad movement. And now Tel Aviv withholds the bodies of 79 Palestinians in its mortuaries, claiming they were killed for operations against Israeli forces. Mona Qandil, Occupy Ramallah.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, close up, Iran.
An Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. From. Suppose it's a canary. This sound comes from the backyard. Oh, my neighbor, Miss Katayun, keeps some domestic canaries in her backyard, and this sound comes from there. They sing beautifully. Miss Katayun is interested in nature, so she has put a lot of green plants in her backyard and has named this place as the Little Hyrkanian Forest. By the way, have you ever heard about Hyrkanian Forest? Today, we are going to Golestan province in order to get familiar with Hyrkanian Forest. Hyrkanian forests have remained from Cenozoic geology and Ice Age. These forests, which date back to 25 to 50 million years ago, are among the most valuable forests in the world. Hyrkanian forests stretch from Hyrkan region in the Azerbaijan Republic to Golestan province in Iran. These forests cover a total area of 2 million hectares in Iran, while the area of these forests in Azerbaijan is 20,000 hectares. 53% of these forests are in Mazandaran province, 26% in Gilan province, and 21% in Golestan province. Hyrkanian forests are among the most valuable forests in the world. In addition to supplying oxygen, these forests play a very important role in saving large amounts of water. These forests also enjoy a vast and diverse flora and fauna. Hyrkanian forests include 80 species of trees, 50 species of shrubs, as well as animals like panther, bear, goat, fox, etc. I am now in Golestan Forest, a very unique and a spectacular forest in East Golestan province. This forest is a part of Hyrkanian Forest. It's interesting to know that these forests are famous as the living fossils. Walking in this forest is really exciting. Oh my god! This part of the forest has many, many beech trees. They are so tall and are grown densely, and actually I can hardly see the sky above. Oh well, I'd better not to raise my head so much. My neck is aching. A beautiful fox. Its head and tail are black, which specializes to this region. I'm very lucky to see a fox here. Oh, pity. It ran away as it realized that I'm here. Here, raspberry shrubs. Very, very delicious. I'd better pick some raspberries and give them to Miss Katayuna as a souvenir from the real Hyrkanian forest. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
the debate.
Hello and welcome to another edition of The Debate. Thousands gathered in London on Saturday to call on G7 leaders to end their support for the Israeli regime. They demanded an end to what they call complicity in Israel's war crimes against Palestinians. In this edition of The Debate, we will scrutinize the role that developed countries are playing in the ongoing suffering of Palestinians and the pro-Palestinian protesters' demands.
As the G7 descended on Cornwall for the summit, thousands of passionate pro-Palestine protesters amassed outside Downing Street in central London on Saturday to vent their anger over ongoing Israeli crimes against the Palestinians.
These protesters are absolutely furious at the lack of action from world leaders following Israel's recent and relentless attacks on Gaza and the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Although a ceasefire has been agreed since then, the fact that Palestinians are still forced to live under an apartheid regime has bitterly fueled the anger of these protesters who want to force a change.
Protesters had various demands, including international recognition of the Palestinian state and an end to Israeli arms sales.
If arms are used in violation of international law, they must be banned, embargoed immediately. Also, the issue of settlement products, they must be banned immediately. Those are illegal products. The recognition of the state of Palestine is long overdue. We do not understand why the UK government is not even listening to the voices of its own people, the voices of its own parliament that voted overwhelmingly to recognize the state of Palestine. The lack of recognition is not only immoral, it is undemocratic.
Place an embargo on Israel. Stop the arms deal. So this is the message that we're sending to the people who are with us. We're in our thousands, and we are going to continue until, honestly, the Palestinians are free and occupation is ended.
We are not going to forget the mark of shame upon the history of this country that brought us to where we are today, the Balfour Declaration. We demand a public apology from the British government, as well as recognition of our state of Palestine. On top of that, we want sanctions now. We want justice. We want action.
The bombs may have temporarily stopped falling, but while Israel's systematic discrimination against the Palestinian people continues, so will the protests. Robert Carter, London.
Now, to discuss that further, we're joined by Youssef Al-Halou, Palestinian journalist and political analyst, who is joining us from London, and also Mr. William Morris from the Next Century Foundation, the Secretary General, of course. Thank you very much for joining us, both of you. Let's begin with Youssef Al-Halou now. Labour lawmaker and former party leader Jeremy Corbyn addressed the crowd and stressed that industrial powers should end human rights abuses. What exactly did he mean by that?
Well, thank you for having me. Let's just assert that despite the fact that the ceasefire is still holding, it is fragile, that ceasefire did not end Israel's military occupation. And to put things into context, the Palestinian cause is gaining momentum. We saw those demonstrators in the British capital demanding the British government to impose embargo or stop arming Israel. Now, Jeremy Corbyn and other political figures, of course, they know clearly that Israel is enjoying a culture of impunity. When it comes to interests, we know that many countries around the world take Israel as a strategic ally. So we are not expecting the G7 leaders to really denounce Israel because obviously Israel is as a proxy for those nations in the Middle East. And also, let me just remind the viewers that even the Palestinian mission in London, Mr. Hussam Zomer, who just spoke in the report, he said that he believes that the UK believes that Israel is violating international law. So such statements from Corbyn or other officials, of course, reflects the hypocrisy of the international community when it comes to the Palestinian rights. Palestinians are being dealt with as subhumans. Are being demonized because simply they are resisting the Israeli occupation.
Thank you very much. Let's bring in Mr. William Morris. In what ways do you believe that the G7 leaders are considered complicit in Israel's war crimes?
I don't even believe you're on the same planet as I am. I don't call them war crimes. I mean, unless you're talking about many governments in the Middle East having committed war crimes. No, I mean, the G7 leaders met to consider China, climate change, and COVID. Israel was not on their agenda, but the Palestinian
Of course, Mr. Morris, this was what the protesters were demanding. We're talking about the protests outside the summit, not what was happening inside the meeting.
Okay, well, there were big issues that occupied their time that they met to discuss. Now, Israel and Palestine has actually is back on the agenda internationally in a major way, and this is actually a consequence of this little war that's gone on. So there is a real opportunity for Middle East peace, and if nations in the region, including Iran, and nations internationally, including the United States of America, tried to really support moves towards a Middle East peace, we might get somewhere this time around. It's very encouraging that we have a new government in Israel. I mean, it's not the kind of government that is perfection, not by a mile, but it's a bit of fresh air. So we have an opportunity. We have an opportunity to build a peace instead of ongoing hatred, and that is an opportunity that should not be lost at this moment.
So, Mr. Morris, how do you believe peace can be achieved as long as Israel is not respecting international law and its international
Full
obligations?
Respect.
I'm referring to the settlement buildings in particular.
International law has never been respected by anybody unless it's convenient to the great powers, Russia or America or whoever. I mean, you know, under international law, Jerusalem should be a state, as you know, a corpus separatum. It should be an international city. International law is utterly meaningless, but what matters is what people care about and what can be done to make for fair play and a way forward. And there's a real opportunity for peace now. It's interesting, Biden, who is a Zionist, but then all of us in the West are Zionists because we all believe in an Israeli state.
Let's bring in Mr. Yusuf Al-Halou.
Yes, about the future.
Thank you very much, Mr. Morris. Let's bring in Yusuf Al-Halou. Now, Mr. Halou, what do you have to say in response to Mr. Morris? He says that, first of all, there were no war crimes committed there, not more than anywhere else in the world, and also international law is not respected by anyone, and that's a good excuse for Israel not to respect international law as well.
Well, even Israeli figures, they say that Israel is an apartheid state. Israel is even worse than apartheid state. And we know that Israel is annoyed from the BDS campaign. That's why it has allocated millions of pounds or dollars to combat those activists who are calling for disarming Israel or sanctioning Israel. Ironically, Israel is being viewed as the only democracy in the Middle East. And Israel is allowed to arm itself to the teeth with military equipment from the United States. And Israel has been using Gaza as a testing ground for its weapons. So Israel is a strategic ally, as I said, to those nations, because obviously there is intelligence collaboration, and Israel is dominating the Western agenda when it comes to self-defense, as if Israel is only allowed to defend itself from those Palestinian, homemade rockets or resistance activities, whereas Palestinians who have been subjected to military brutal occupation since 1948, they have no right whatsoever to defend themselves. So obviously crimes were committed, atrocities, ethnic cleansing is still ongoing since 1948. So obviously everybody knows that Israel has violated the numerous UN resolutions. Israel, considers itself above the international law. It's a rogue state. It has never respected any regulation or convention or international UN Security Council resolution.
Mr. Al-Halou, Mr. Morris believes that now, with a new Israeli government, of course that is if they win the vote of confidence from the Knesset, with a new Israeli government, there will be hope for peace. How optimistic are you?
We are not optimistic at all because we know that the Israeli government or Israeli successive governments, they use Palestinian blood as a winning card. You know, we know the settlers, they are allowed to behave in this provocative manners, attacking Palestinians, confiscating Palestinian lands in Sheikh Jarrah or elsewhere. So we do not pin high hopes on any government because we know from previous experiences that Israel is not interested in peace, and this is crystal clear.
Thank you very much. Mr. Morris, you heard Ms. Al-Halu. He says that Israel is basically not interested in peace, and the settlement buildings also confirm that. So why do you think a new government in Israel, which of course we do know the right wing still has the most power, and those are the ones that insist on the settlement buildings, why do you think there's room for peace?
Much of your rhetoric, and I'm sorry, is based on hatred. And if you go on about apartheid state and hate, you're not going to build a climate for peace. And if you are no hopers that regard the situation as being hopeless, then you may as well crawl into a hole and forget it. I mean, people have to work for peace. And there is a real need, both on the Palestinian side as well as on the Israeli side, for new government and for a new approach. Abu Mazen has lost the plot. I mean, he scarcely has any credibility. Hamas say they won't. It's very convenient for them that they don't have to negotiate with Israel because they can say Israel won't negotiate with them. It's all very childish. But we have a situation in which the Palestinians have given Israel a wake-up call, and nobody can take the Palestinians for granted anymore. So it is time and opportunity to build peace now, and to build on this current situation and to find a better way forward. And the international powers can help in this, and not just the United States of America, but Russia, Britain, and the others. And I think there is a mood, a genuine mood, to do something. It does require help from the Palestinians, and it requires help from countries like Iran. I mean, Iran arguably provided weapons to Gaza. I don't know. You know better than I would. But so, I mean, Iran is a player in this game. I don't think we'd have peace in the Middle East unless Iran is interested in helping build peace in the Middle East. But it's an opportunity.
Well, Iran's position has always been very clear, Mr. Morris. They want what the people of Palestine want. Iran has always been a supporter of Palestinian people, and Iran has always called for a referendum to decide what should happen in Israel. Now, let's go back to our topic, which was the protest. Mr. Morris, what was the demands of this Resist G7 coalition? What were they trying to achieve, and do you believe that they got close to their goals or not?
I think it's important that there were protests because it does help raise, I mean, there are protests on many things, as you know, at this moment, not just on Israel and Palestine, but there are many, many protests around the G7 on a whole range of issues. The most predominant one was on climate change, but nonetheless, it does help having this kind of, this raised awareness of the situation in Israel and Palestine. And so protests matter. They matter hugely in the West. They make a great difference. As to the rhetoric we hear, I mean, much of it is pretty extreme and unhelpful, but that's not the point. The point is that the issue is back on the table. Peace is back on the table. We have an opportunity. And you refer to settlement building. One of Abu Mazen's sins has been to halt peace negotiations as long as settlement building continues. Makes a very easy excuse for people, right-wingers like Benjamin Netanyahu, who can rub his hands in glee. I mean, something Arafat would never have done. He can rub his hands in glee and sit back and say, okay, so they won't talk to us, so we won't talk to them. But fortunately, we have the chance of a new government in Israel. We just need the same in Palestine, and we might move forward.
Thank you very much. Mr. Al-Halu, what is your response to Mr. Morris? Do you believe that there is a chance for peace with a new government in Palestine?
Well, we Palestinians, we are peace-loving people. Well, we hope so. You know, there will always be hope. But we know that according to Oslo Accords, by the year 2000, Palestinians should have had their own Palestinian state, and Israel destroyed the Palestinian cause ever since the provocative visit of Sharon at the time in the year 2000. We are fed up from this occupation. Enough is enough. And Netanyahu himself, he repeated many times saying that the land is too small to be shared. So it's obvious that Israel is not interested to have a Palestinian state next to its... and by the way, let's just make it clear, Israel has no recognized border. Israel has no constitution. So what peace we are talking about? Gaza, West Bank, East Jerusalem is less than 20% of historic Palestine. So even if this historic, if this viable Palestinian state was agreed to be established, then it will be demilitarized. I mean, Palestinians are really eager to see peace prevail in the Middle East. But unfortunately, that we are being let down. We don't have high hopes when it comes to assuring Palestinians, oh, you have to adopt the nonviolent resistance, the peaceful methods. We tried everything. And by the way, President Abbas is Israel's best Palestinian leader at the time, because obviously, it's not a hidden fact that the Palestinian Authority has made many concessions, whether it's during Arafat era or Abbas era. So any Palestinian leader, obviously, the Palestinian side is the weakest side. Let's disagree on that. Israel is the one who's dictating these rules because the Palestinian Authority is receiving the financial support from donor countries. So Palestinians, they have no sovereignty. So at the end of the day, let's hope that the new government in Israel will strike deal with the Palestinians. But we don't have high hopes, to be honest.
Now, Mr. Al-Halu, Mr. Morris also mentioned that the voices of Palestinians are now being heard. Do you believe so?
I think the new generation is making a huge impact and effect. We saw the activists in Sheikh Jarrah. We saw new faces on the ground. The Palestinian cause is back to the forefront. What happened recently in those neighborhoods in Jerusalem or the aggression on Gaza has sent shockwaves. It's an awakening because the world also is fed up. The world is annoyed from the fact that Israel continues year after year, day after day, with the occupation, atrocities, killing, imprisonment, confiscation of lands, and so on. The list is too long. So let's just put things into context. Israel can end the occupation now if it wants to, but it doesn't want that because it enjoys the control of other people, the Palestinians.
Thank you very much. Mr. Morris, now you heard what Mr. Al-Halu said. On the other hand, you seem to be very optimistic. So if you could please tell us about this demonstration, and you did also mention that their voices are heard and now they can make an impact. Do you believe that these G7 leaders will take any steps in order to get closer to the goal that you mentioned, peace?
Oh, 100%. I think it's a priority for Biden, less so perhaps for the others, but Biden has sort of begun to indicate that he really does care about this issue. Now, I did say he was a Zionist, but he has done some interesting little things. He's reopened the U.S., well, what was it, a consulate, but basically the U.S. offices in East Jerusalem, which haven't been there for, 20 years, 30 years? I mean, I can't remember them being open. So he's beginning to make a kind of a move. And I'm very encouraged. I think that there is a care about the man. He does care about the Israel-Palestine situation. And he wants a viable Israeli state as well as a viable Palestinian state. He's a two-state man, whatever his sins. So, you know, I think, and he'd be better with regard to Iran. He's compared to Donald Trump, he's a breath of fresh air. I would like to see a new leader on the Palestinian side, someone like Marwan Barghouti, who could actually negotiate peace, but isn't actually
asleep all the time. But that said, it is an opportunity, and we do have a chance for a better tomorrow. Now.
So, Mr. Morris, protesters were also predominantly talking about BDS, the boycott, the divestment, and sanctions movement, to force Israel to respect Palestinian rights. Do you think this has played a role in pushing Israel towards moving towards peace?
You're an Iranian, and you support sanctions. You know what they've done to Iran. Sanctions are always wrong, always wrong. I mean, okay, arguably against apartheid South Africa. But they've, since that day, they've never been effective. All they've done is punished ordinary people, punished ordinary Iranians or ordinary Syrians. Look at Syria under sanctions. I mean, you know, it's and the BDS, I mean, boycott. Well, fortunately, in my view, it's not made that much of an impression. But what has made an impression is these protests. They do matter. And if you want, the biggest thing in the United Kingdom where I'm living has been the Balfour Initiative. I don't know whether you've come across it, but that was very powerful, an activist campaign for a Palestinian state, which was very respected and brought Corbyn on board and his team. So, I mean, we have an opportunity. Actually, there is a Palestinian state. There is a Palestinian state. Let's just make this clear. And the campaign for greater recognition is an important one, as Mr. Helou mentioned. It's a very important one. It's gaining momentum, and I think that matters a great deal.
So, Mr. Al-Helou, what is your opinion regarding the BDS movement?
Well, solidarity is as important as the BDS campaign. Well, this is what Palestinians are adopting. They say that the BDS is effective, and this can be seen from Israel's reaction by fighting those activists worldwide, by classifying those BDS activists as anti-Semite. We know that Israel is also annoyed from the growing solidarity when it comes to celebrities. We've seen the angry reaction from Israeli officials towards those celebrities, Ms. Hadid and the other ones. So this is what the Palestinians are left with. You know, Palestinians have tried everything. And they hope that by following the footsteps of the South African experience, this might mount pressure on Israel. What they can do. Israel has got, the powerful army in the region, whereas Palestinians, when they throw stones, they are described as terrorists. So we have a double standard policy here. Palestinians, they will try everything possible on the table just to make their voices heard.
Thank you very much. Mr. Youssef Al-Helou, Palestinian journalist and political analyst, joining us from London, and also Mr. William Morris, the Next Century Foundation Secretary General. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen for joining us on this edition of The Debate.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Global leaders arriving in Cornwall for the G7 summit have already found themselves in a changed world. Face masks and social distancing have replaced the usual hugs, handshakes, and cheek-pecking. The entourages have slimmed down, and the usual media circus has been muted, with protesters having to contend themselves with writing sad messages on the beach. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian's environment correspondent Fiona Harvey. The piece is titled, G7 leaders face make-or-break moment in climate crisis. Stay with us for more of Fiona Harvey's article. Global leaders arriving in Cornwall for the G7 summit have already found themselves in a changed world. Face masks and social distancing have replaced the usual hugs, handshakes, and cheek-pecking. The entourages have slimmed down, and the usual media circus has been muted, with protesters having to contend themselves with writing sad messages on the beach. Boris Johnson has faced ridicule and accusations of hypocrisy for travelling to Carbis Bay by private jet. Some of the other leaders have been more concerned about the extent to which quarantine rules apply to them. But amid the ever-present reminders that 2021 is a year unlike any other, one of the biggest changes will be entirely invisible. Carbon dioxide is now at a higher level in the atmosphere than at any point in the last 4 million years, new released data has shown. The world has entered uncharted territory where global heating is concerned and greenhouse gas emissions are rising strongly still. The message could not be clearer. If the world fails to act now, the future will be changed beyond anything the coronavirus pandemic has brought about. Lord Stern, the climate economist, said, "This is a crucial moment in history. Either we recover from the pandemic in a strong and sustainable way, or we don't. We are at a real fork in the road. This decade is decisive." Scientists have made it clear that greenhouse gas emissions must be halved by 2030 if the world is to stay within 1.5 degrees Celsius of global heating, the threshold beyond which extreme weather will take hold. Small islands and low-lying areas will face inundation, and swathes of the world will face water stress and heat waves. Stern pointed to the checkered progress of the past 10 years, in which the cost of renewable energy has plunged and technology such as electric vehicles has increased, but in which progress on cutting emissions overall has been painfully slow. The last decade was not very good, and this next decade could be just as bad or even worse if we make the wrong choices, he said. G7 countries are responding, all of the leaders coming to Cornwall, from United States, United Kingdom, Japan, Canada, Germany, France, Italy, and the European Union, have affirmed their commitment to holding temperature rises to no more than 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, the lower limit set out in the 2015 Paris Agreement. All have long-term targets to reach net zero emissions by 2050, and nearly all have targets to cut carbon in the next decade. The United Kingdom has led with the goal of cutting emissions by 68% by 2030 and by 78% by 2035, based on 1990 levels. The United States will halve emissions by 2030 based on 2005 levels, and the European Union will make cuts by at least 55% by 2030 on a 1990 baseline. Our current plans under the Paris Climate Accord from Japan and Canada have been criticized by campaigners as inadequate, and they are under pressure to toughen their targets before COP26, the crucial United Nations climate talks to be held in Glasgow, Scotland, this November. There has been also progress in the run-up to the Cornwall summit. All of the G7 countries have agreed to halt the funding of coal and coal-fired power stations, a huge step forward in making a global move away from the dirtiest fossil fuel. Yet none of this is enough. Global carbon dioxide output is forecast to jump by an almost record amount this year as the world returns to economic growth using fossil fuels, instead of making the leap needed to renewable energy and low-carbon energy. G7 countries are falling behind on the green recovery from COVID-19 that experts have been urging for more than a year, and reliance on coal has increased in some parts of the world, including the United States of America. The situation is worse in non-G7 countries. China, the world's biggest emitter of greenhouse gases and second biggest economy, is not represented at the G7 summit. China's reliance on coal has increased further in the recovery from COVID-19, despite the country's long-term goal of net zero emissions by 2050. Fateh Birol, Executive Director of International Energy Agency, IEA, said that while rich countries were cutting their greenhouse gas emissions, some developing countries would continue to increase theirs unless they could gain far more investment in shifting to a low-carbon economy. Fateh Birol said more than 90% of emissions in the next two decades will come from emerging economies, but they are less than 20% of global clean energy investment. He added, if we can't accelerate the clean energy transition in these countries, I believe this will be the most critical fault line in global efforts to reach climate goals. To fund the shift to clean energy and to cope with the effects of climate breakdown, developing countries will need help from the richer countries. So far, promises of finance have not been met. Under a long-standing pledge made in 2009, poor countries were supposed to receive $100 billion a year from public and private sources by 2020. That target has certainly been missed, and the pressure is now on the G7, the grouping of the world's wealthiest countries, to find a way of plugging the gap, a crucial step in gaining developing countries' backing for any climate deal at the COP26, the United Nations Climate Summit in Glasgow, Scotland.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.